a ton of articles recently on commondreams.org, but his stuff is amazing. He's going into detail about how not only are they not reversing the policies of the Bush administration, they're actually going out of their way to protect them. In case of torture, just today or yesterday, and Greenwald has been covering this in the last week extensively, they're doing everything to make sure that the torture memos are not released, that that the Justice Department isn't going to pursue former war criminals. They're going to let that pass.
Yes.
A number, and they're also and directly violating the law in the case of Geithner and Summers, because the law now requires that if the bank comes out and if a Wall Street bank comes out and says we're screwed and these are how much our assets are worth, then the government is forced to act.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that they're doing to essentially break the law and to protect these people is by saying, well, we don't know how much they're worth, but not forcing them to say how much they're worth or how much do you have of bad assets.
Right.
So they're sort of finding a way to funnel a shit pile of cash towards them that they can create another bubble with, but it doesn't address the fundamental issues. And a lot of this would be, I would recommend that people go to counterpunch.org and check out Mike Whitney's stuff, check out Michael Hudson's work, and Paul Craig Roberts has been writing a lot about this. But basically, they are doing everything in their power to protect the interests of these Wall Street bankers at the expense of, you know, us and the rest of the world, for that matter.
I agree with you. I mean, I know they're doing a dance around insolvency. I know that. That's pretty clear. And I think what they're trying, what the Obama administration is trying to do, is have it be forced upon them. And the two things they were going to use to do that, one is backfiring right before their eyes, and one hasn't taken effect yet. The notion that they would auction toxic assets would then show X number of banks to be insolvent and then force the hand of the FDIC to come in and nationalize. Or I forgot the actual technical term. Nationalize is what they used to
well, I mean,
receivership.
That's basically right.
And then the other thing, though, the thing that I thought that they were going to use that would sort of force them to do it is the so-called stress test, which they now have to conceal, because there's no way to release the results of the stress test without causing a run on the banks that failed the stress test. So they kind of got themselves caught.
Well, as of today, weren't they still going to release those results?
They've now opted to not necessarily release them.
What, for fear that there would be a run on banks?
There'll be a run on banks. There'll be, what will happen is anyone who got a failing grade, there'll be a run on. You're right. You're right on that. And honestly, the one of the focuses of the show has been, what is the answer to this, to that financial mess? There seems to be a $4 trillion hole.
But, you know, because one could argue that it isn't deception, but actually practicality. You know, if you do expose someone, they're going to be picked to the bone, and that's going to...
Well, the ramifications could be greater than just that.
Well, the other issue is that his appointments are the same people who started the crisis to begin with, which I'm sure you've talked about.
That's very disturbing.
Well, yeah, the Clinton people that went along with the Republican ideas in the 90s.
But not just that. I mean, Geithner, who was right in the middle of everything that was going on in New York, is a big example of that.
Well, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act was actually either Summers or Rubin, both of whom were active in the Clinton administration. When Bush got elected, they went right into Citigroup.
Yeah.
They come get out of, and Obama gets in office, they come right back in to protect the same interests that they were helping, you know, to destroy or, you know, create this bubble to begin with and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's, you know, but it's, come on, I mean, we can't be fooled at all by this, because where did he get a lot of his cash, you know? A lot of his money...
Supposedly small donations
over there. Yeah, right.
That's the way to do it, but...
It's good PR, I'll say that.
I know, and honestly, I never understood how it worked that $25 donations were propelling him to record, you know, fundraising.
Chomsky was on Amy Goodman's show this week. You should listen to it if you can, on Monday, I believe, or Tuesday. But he goes into all this detail, too. But yeah, of course, you know. He was quoting the numbers, and where the business community and the financial like tight quotes of Financial Times, I think, but the business community, that's they wanted Obama because there was going to be much better for business, and he went into a lot of details about that. I mean, there was such a credibility gap, you know, with Bush that these people are about making money, right? So what's going to be better for business? Well, they put their money where they wanted it to go, you know.
Yeah, especially because all outward signs, whether or not they're true, showed that McCain would probably make it worse.
Yeah.
For them, for the business community.
It's all good.
They did, though, today, I don't know if you've seen them, and I haven't either, so I don't want to comment on the authenticity of them, but apparently a bunch of Bush torture memos were released by the Obama White House today, along with the statement that they were not going to prosecute CIA interrogators for following them.
Yeah, that's like the headline should have read, Obama declares Nuremberg trials illegitimate. Seriously, because that's what they're saying. Because the Nazis were prosecuted, the people who were following orders, who were in a position of power within the Nazi regime,
right,
were prosecuted, and they tried to say, I was just following orders, and Nuremberg said no, and I'm sorry, that's not good enough.
That's true, but how do I explain this? I mean, when I read through a lot of your stuff and I saw the links, I was like, you know, I know that what you're saying is right, especially that. That's actually a great point, I have to concede. But at the same time, this is not post-World War II, and that is... My big thing is that's untenable politically in the United States.
Well, who cares about the United States? The rest of the world seems to be far more... well, I hate to use the word civilized, but I will. You know what I'm saying? Like, well, you know, somebody they're prosecuting these people in Spain,
yeah,
and they're going ahead with it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're holding up to the agreements, the international law, in which the U.S. is a signatory to and should be holding up these people for criminal prosecution, but of course they won't.
Apparently, England's doing the same thing. They have a list of people that they're thinking about prosecuting for war crimes.
Yeah, I know. And Nancy Pelosi really wants to do something too. But the bottom line is, though, I mean, let's just face domestic politics only. If Obama did decide to allow prosecution of people who followed Bush administration order or Bush administration rules,
he would be following the law. I agree.
I have no problem with that. How would you feel when Eric Cantor was Speaker of the House in 2010?
My first response to that is, politics is the shadow cast by big business over society, which is a quote from somebody a long time ago, which I remember. Somebody will know that what I'm talking about. But it's true. This stuff that we're talking about and participating in, mm-hmm, in this country is a distraction to the real political power, you know. And I think we're at such a stage environmentally that, you know, ultimately we should really come back to what to me is we have to come to some point at which we actually challenge the ability of capitalism to continue. And I think ultimately the discussion, I think we're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic when we're talking about elections, when we're talking about who's the Speaker of the House. I mean, the state of the environmental crisis and what industrial civilization is doing to the planet is so drastic, in my opinion, that, you know, I read this stuff and I'm kind of aware of it enough to understand it, but I do think ultimately we need another way through this, because there is no, in my opinion, I don't think there's, you know, democracy in the U.S. I think it's more of a rubber stampocracy, and a you know, honestly, and it's a kleptocracy, it's a meritocracy. I don't think this is a system we're trying to defend for a lot of reasons. But, you know, that's another discussion. But so when every time I come back to these sort of details about who's Speaker of the House, and I don't mean to belittle the question, because I know that's what a lot of people talk about, right?
Right.
But, you know, I come back to that statement. Politics is the shadow cast by big business over society, and it is sort of a distraction to the real core of power that runs the United States.
Right. And okay, I have a couple questions for you. In that view, which I've been told, I've had friends whose parents worked for NSA and stuff like that, and they've said, you know, there is no changing it. When Clinton won in 92, one of my roommates said it was because the moneyed class, the ruling class, figured he wouldn't do anything to screw up their power. He was vetted, essentially.
Absolutely. They're all vetted, for sure.
So, but in that view, the predominant force is an organization or a power structure. Let's say a power structure, not an organization.
Certainly, yeah.
It doesn't take into account the human factor of the people who actually go out and vote via whatever manipulation gets them out to vote. It doesn't take into account that the vast majority of people are not going to find the third way. They flick the left button when the right button didn't work, and they flick the right button when the left button didn't work. I mean, so if you, I agree with you that structure is there. I mean, a lot of people say that. I mean, I'm from New York, so you know, you grow up with a bunch of people, and they're like, you know, the mob runs everything. Right. You know, it's, you know.
Well, in one way or another, that's true too. But I think that, you know, I go back to my first statement. I think it's sort of fundamentally interwoven into the DNA of this nation. It's always been here and founded in the sense of making money. It's always been about capitalism. We rejected European powers and we kept the powers for ourselves. It's sort of always been what we've done, despite whatever social evolutions have occurred. So I don't know. I don't know how easy it would be to rid this place of capitalism, because it's sort of, that's what it is in a way. It's this machine, this engine that kind of went on its own and ran amok.
And capitalism by nature is a corrupting force. If you are, in theory, supposed to have democracy, this thing that reacts to people's
wishes, one could argue to the counter that, you know, it has no ethics whatsoever other than the ethics that people apply to it, and then that becomes another question. You know, what if the people don't will things, then they're allowing it to happen,
right? Which is why I'm always a pragmatist about this, to a certain extent.
Well, I mean, okay, there's a lot to say. I would just say, well, the nation is founded on slavery and genocide.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It's founded on the stealing of land and the murder of something on the order of 90% of the native population, and built on slavery. You know, that's where the money came
and
from to build this.
Cheap labor exploitation, which was that close to slavery.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I agree with you. You know, there's no easy way out of this. Mm-hmm. And I've become more and more of a cynic on that, in that respect. But, you know, I still think I've really gotten to the point where, you know, I don't necessarily pretend to have the right answers, but I also don't want to pretend to not. I don't want to not tell the truth about the way I see things. I think if the least I can do is just to be honest,
okay,
at how I see it, and I don't mean to point fingers at anybody and say that I do have the answers, but I do think an honest, you know, discussion would require that we address that capitalism is predicated upon the endless growth, and we live on a finite planet,
right,
and it's going to run out one way or another. And if and you know, we see this with, you know, 90% of the big fish in the oceans are gone. We see this with the destruction of so many aspects of the environment.
I mean, Australia's been on fire since January. I mean, the country's been burning to hell, and they'll tell you that there's global warming for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to work in oceanography, and I was author on a paper that investigated sea surface water temperatures a long time ago, and this was at a time when Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and people were very conservative about, the scientists there were like, well, we know it's real, but they didn't want to come out in public. right? And it took literally 15 years before now they'll come out and say, of course it's real.
Right.
But now a lot more data has been collected. We know this is a serious issue, and we know it's what's driving it. You know, we know that the use of resources, oil and fossil fuels and everything else that we know is causing this. And I don't see this train stopping at any time soon.
My theory on this has always been that we're going to run our course with this, and we're going to take it to the nth degree and be forced to change when we have to, and find some way within that to actually make a profit out of something. That's always been the MO. We solve our problems when we have to.
There's a lot of people who have felt that when the human race is facing extinction, that someone's brain will turn its focus to it and figure out some way out of it. There are a bunch of people. I mean,
the pathetic thing is that many of the answers actually exist already. We simply don't. The system hasn't found a way to exploit them.
Well, this would be my question to you, Chris, which is, aren't we, at least the United States, such a large enough country that if we did start to change, if we did start to actually have real results, it would be exponential in its results. Not necessarily to save the world, but we could, if we did actually start to embark on true carbon, you know, savings, carbon neutrality, if we started to reduce our impact.
You mean instead of buying, you know, waivers?
Yeah.
Trading carbon.
Yeah, trading carbon waivers.
Haven't you? I've never. Yeah,
but that's virtual.
Yeah.
But I'll trade two burnings of gasoline gallons for your wood burning stove that you need for a week.
Yeah. No. But I mean, don't you think that in that sense that because everything's on such a grand scale that as you start to reform, if you were able to, it would start to show bigger results?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly, look, yes, it'll have an impact, mm-hmm. but there's still a lot of countries like China and Europe, and China because it's growing and wants to grow tremendously. There's a lot of people who want the lifestyle that people see that the U.S. has in the West, the consumption of resources. It's going to take such a transformational shift in consciousness and consumption that, you know, I'm very cynical about it. But more importantly, and I've always said this to, you know, people based on the, I tend to read a lot of these environmental papers that come out just because I like to follow up on that stuff, and I think the IPCC has been extremely conservative mm-hmm. in their statements, because I don't know, from what I have understood about that process, you know, there's about 2,000 scientists on it.
Is it the UN one or is it?
Yeah,
yeah.
The International Panel on Climate Change, and there's this sort of that the consensus that they come to is extremely conservative. There's a number of scientists there who think we've already gone past that point.
Yes.
And there's a lot of examples in history, geological history, that triggers when they actually happen get to a point where there's no reversal of that trigger. And there's a good example of that actually coming from the last ice age into what's called this interglacial cycle right now that happened about 10,000 years ago. And there's a really good example of that. I won't get into it, but if we want to, we can. But there's a lot of good examples of triggers happening when then the systems get pushed to a point mm-hmm. where it's very linear up to that point, and after that point it becomes very nonlinear. Mm-hmm. So when it hits that point, shit can hit the fan in so many ways
right.
that we don't really understand. And I really am, and you know, a lot of people, for example, a paper just came out in like the Independent, I think, or the Guardian. The UK covers this stuff really well, by the way. The London Independent and the Guardian are good about these papers and doing these articles. But just to illustrate the point, they thought that the temperature around the Antarctic to reach 9 degrees Fahrenheit increase would take about 7 years.
Yeah.
They're seeing this happening now.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about like a 70-year difference.
Yes.
And I think I think a lot of these predictions where people say, well, we got 100 years, well, we got 50, well, we got 20. I'm much more cynical, and I think a trigger could happen within the next 5 to 10,
yeah.
which would actually could potentially be a shift in consciousness, could be a shift in the way people perceive the economic system and capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the damage that we're doing right now could actually happen a lot sooner, a lot quicker, a lot more harsh,
yeah.
in a lot more harsher terms. So I don't know. But that's something I think about a lot. And Also, I don't think that we have the right to destroy the planet because we're taking out about 50,000 species a year.
Right.
You know, and there's those issues. And I'll shut up in a minute, but I do want to recommend Derek Jensen's books. He wrote Endgame. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, it's one of those books that really makes me made me upset to read it at first because it really fundamentally challenged a lot of things I thought and took for granted. But I loved it, mm-hmm. and I love being challenged that way. But I highly recommend his stuff just to get your mind shifted to a different perspective and then come back and go, well, is he right or is he wrong? But right. answering that question.
I agree with you on that. There's my anecdotal evidence is the prediction are the predictions on the ice shelves. That the way they said that they would break off and melt, how many years in advance and how quickly that's happening. Stuff that was supposed to happen 20 years ago.
No, it's kind of amazing. We started noticing holes in the ozone layer, what, in the 70s?
Yeah.
Nobody really understood what they were there for, what was going on, what did that mean, and now?
To be honest with you, one of the lasting legacies of the Bush administration was that the world came, the United States, the ignorant United States, those people who, that I...
You mean
we
walked out of Kyoto, or...?
No, that the people in the United States have come to a majority opinion that global warming is real. When Bush took office, he was saying it still wasn't real. Reagan said it wasn't real. There were people who just said it just wasn't happening, that it could be just part of a cycle.
Yeah.
And the one good thing of his mismanagement of the country it was that was dispelled to the point where people who have admitted to me, what I found interesting was older people. People in their 70s just didn't believe it.
You mean the ones with all the skin cancer now?
Yeah, but they didn't believe it. They didn't think it was true, and they've said in the last 6 to 8 years...
They're seeing it with their own eyes, and they're experiencing it. They know.
By the way, I read an article, like I think in 2007, on the UN report on climate change, and it was in the LA Times, and I'm sitting there trying to eat breakfast, right? Reading this freaking paper, and... it says X number of scientists will not sign their name to the UN climate change report. It's too watered down. But predictions are dire anyway.
Right, yeah. But they're still dire.
Really, really frightening.
And it was and the basics of it were like a 3% change in ocean temperature will basically a three degree change in average climate temperature or ocean temperature will basically punish the poorest nations first. The poor people in almost every nation will pay the price first. And then it just went through these horrible things about flooding and saltwater contamination of certain countries, essentially,
right.
of fertile lands. And I was like, God, that was watered down. And I've talked to Republicans, and I've asked them, are you factoring in, global warming retirement? And they're like, yeah, Canada looks great.
As much as we're still dealing with Katrina, I mean, Katrina was a convergence of every issue facing this country.
Yeah.
You know, environmental destruction that has gone on for about 100 years. You know, the erosion of all those outer islands that used to protect New Orleans for centuries, as well as all the racial and class issues all converging to one hideous
right.
open sore that's still open.
Yeah.
And we still haven't found a way to kind of work through all that.
Which, by the way, Karl Rove exploited to great... it was the downfall of the Bush administration, but the shattering of the minority voting class... in New Orleans by shipping them off to
shipping
Texas.
Shipping them off to Texas,
Was
that was clever.
Carl
they got
Rhodes,
something out of it.
Genius. Well,
but...
I mean, it's kind of funny because I agree with you on a lot of stuff, and I know that you see issues on a deeper level. Oh, go ahead.
That's to be expected.
Right.
You know, that they would exploit something. You know, you're dying and something's bleeding and wounding and festering. Let me figure out how to exploit this. But I was saying the fact remains that all these issues are still sitting there on the plate, and these people are pushing that Bobby Jindal idiot forward. And I'm sorry.
Right.
I mean, you've got to reconcile all that together and then talk to me.
Right.
You know, what is this?
That's Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism, right?
Yeah.
New Orleans was the key example.
Well, yeah, they were buying land when it was still underwater.
Right.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. True. Truly.
I didn't know that.
Truly. Yes.
Well, you wrote first.
You can always think forward. Okay, this will be. It's a strategic place.
Sooner or later, it will.
It's a strategic place at the bottom of the Mississippi, the top of the Gulf of Mexico. That's why it exists in the first place. So. Even if it takes 5 years to dry out, I want this land.
Right, right.
Yeah, or whatever it is, this position.
Well, yeah. No, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what people do.
Well, here especially.
Yeah. There's two things I wanted to say. One is, I think I screwed up the recording of the show again.
Tonight?
Yeah. So we've got a lot of it, but just for the sake... If everyone out there hears this a second time, forget it.
You're going to break your hand.
I just want to say, Chris Burnett is the guest tonight on What's Left. And Chris Burnett's been active in indie media for quite some time. Well-read. I think I told that guy that night, one of the most formidable minds in Los Angeles. Whoa. And then you showed up like 2 seconds later.
You conjured up with your powers. You conjured him with your drunken powers.
With my crutch.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the part that cracked me up too, is that I think the last time I saw you, you were on crutches. And
that's true.
When I met Katrina, she had knee surgery. It was all this sort of everything coming around.
Crutch land.
Yeah. But Chris Burnett's on. He has a show. He does a 3 times a month show on KPFK, Indie Media on Air. And I want to get the link out to... I don't know what to call it, other than like an open letter, or was it just an email?
Yeah, it was just an open letter. It was on. I published it on Indie Media, LA, IMC.
Right, which is definitely...
Obama and the U.S. Empire.
Yeah, definitely Google that and definitely read up on it. Well, now, you wrote that from... the elation of post-election to just before inauguration, or maybe inauguration since then.
Not his personal elation, the public elation.
No, he's watching the elation of the public, or it's supposed. Since then, if you were to write another one, do you have any broad outlines you would mention?
Well, no, I mean, I think I covered the gist of it, which is that I don't think we'll ever... I mean, depends on what, you know, people's goals and ethics are and where they, how they see themselves in the society, if they want a real fundamental change or right. They're happy with the status quo. And
but you've had 90 days of Obama actually doing things.
And I haven't seen a damn thing change.
That's what I was getting at. Okay.
If anything, I think he's worse than McCain. And the reason I think he's worse, arguably, is because he's able to do all this stuff without serious protest.
Yes.
And, you know, this invasion of Afghanistan is ridiculous. This, you know, and you just need to, you know, you spend any time reading the, even, you know, a lot of former military officers going, this is ridiculous. You know,
these are ridiculous. Even if you want to do it, even if you have a will to do it, it's dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And then and you compare the numbers in terms of land size and the force that would be required to sort of maintain like control of that kind of region is enormous. Even you know, Vietnam was very tiny. Had a larger population, but they had an enormous force that they estimated that they could keep control of the country, and they obviously lost. But you know, Afghanistan has a history of fighting off empire.
Yeah,
we know a thing or two about right. that. But I think that's it's one of the fundamental mistakes that big countries make is to underestimate, you know, what a small person, one individual can do to your right. big, vulnerable
right.
machine.
Right.
I mean, the French learned that. The word sabotage comes from those old wooden shoes that the peasants would drop into a machine and then say, I don't know what happened, but everybody would get a day off. So it's we have to beware. We talked about this last week. We're very vulnerable in many, many ways.
Well, this is where I horrify Chris in saying, I don't think they want to control Afghanistan. I think they want to launch attacks into
well, they've said that's what they want to do.
Their basic goal is not to control it, is to have it remain fundamentally whatever way it wants, but they want to be able to bomb the crap out of the region that goes into Pakistan.
Surgical strikes, they're called.
But well, not going to be.
Yeah,
I mean, I would.
They won't be. They never are.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What's up with them bombing soccer games, weddings, and you know, it's so repetitive, happens so many times that I don't believe it's an accident. But my point was, the bigger point is that, you know, I really highly recommend people check out Chalmers Johnson's work on the U.S. Empire. He has 3 books. It's a trilogy. But basically, this I think Afghanistan is a continuation of the policy that they wanted in Iraq and succeeded in, is military bases are essentially what define the empire.
Yeah.
Right? And they're used as sort of a jumping off point for sort of a game of hegemony over Russia and China and these other, you know, international global political games that they're playing.
Right.
And, you know, and it fits within a context of plans that are obviously sitting in some room somewhere in Washington or in the Pentagon that we don't know about, but it's pretty clear that they have a game plan.
Well, they have a plan to go to war with almost every major country in the world.
And they also need the justification for the economic situation at home. You know, the contractors, the military contractors, and all the money, the billions of dollars that are spent, that's an economy. And, you know, the people at home need wars in order to justify channeling public monies into the private, you know, hands of, you know, military contractors and corporations. But, so the whole system works together.
And it's such BS because it's been proven that wars don't actually, aside from World War II, don't really stimulate economies in a way that's meaningful.
They tend to lead to an economic recession or worse.
So,
But it makes a lot of people rich who are getting directly...
And the people who are rich survive those economic downturns very...
But I guess I'm speaking in terms of the good of the people. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
How naive.
You see, this is where it infuriates people. This is where I take into account the playing field that Obama's working in. And I agree with you. I kind of actually have a little bit more hope in the guy and in some of the people that... are part of the mistakes made in the past, or part of the power structure that, you know, gorged itself to the point of overeating to death. And the reason why is that there's a certain amount of unsustainability to this all. And I think that they recognize that to a certain extent. And they can't radically, and by radically, I mean they can't just clearly and plainly address it. They have to play the game in order to get it. I do think there's a certain amount of power in Washington, especially now. If ever there was more power in Washington over corporations than 10 years ago.
Power over?
Mm-hmm.
By whom?
Well...
Not by me.
No.
Or
but
by the people.
The talk of actually regulating banks to the point where they're
But they're not talking about regulating banks.
Yeah, they are.
Well, they're forced to now talk about something that sounds like regulation, but when you look at the details, is actually a giveaway in order to, you know, bail them out and create another bubble. Because the people I've read who've actually understood the economics and actually explain it to people like me who don't read economics textbooks, the stuff that I'm walking away from this, and again I point to Dr. Michael Hudson, Pam Martins, Mike Whitney, Paul Craig Roberts. They're all authors and writers on counterpunch.org. They go into this in detail, and you can go there and search their stuff. But basically, this is a scam, and it is a whitewash. And Obama, you know, probably doesn't have much power to challenge the system. But basically, it's gotten to the point, and these people argue, and many others have, is that this is essentially a coup of the U.S. government at the highest levels. You know, these people are being rewarded for their casino gambling. You know, these people are being rewarded instead of, you know, let quote unquote too big to fail nonsense, which essentially means that, you know, they represent the money class and they are not going to fail whether we like it or not. You know, so I agree. You know, Obama, I'm not saying Obama seems like a decent guy, but that means nothing in a system of power this big to me.
Well, also, I mean, where's the populist rage gone over all of this anyway? Remember that? The pitchforks?
Well, I mean...
People just seem exhausted by the entire thing.
People gave up on all that. But I think that... How do I explain this? I hear what you're saying, but I don't see it quite the same way. I think from what I've been told and what I've read, and I haven't read in-depth economic text either, but the basics of it is if you really let the quote-unquote market forces work, that those who made bad bets lose and those who were with them lose along with them, I'm not sure the amount of people it would dislodge from, like, their jobs would be so large.
Well, I think that's the party line. I don't believe that, but I mean,
they.
We're never going to know. That's the point. We're never going to know.
But we kind of know. We kind of know when Paulson chose not to bail out Lehman, things got a hell of a lot worse.
Well, the other thing is look, these are like spoiled brats on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, if there's even a hint publicly by anybody in position of power that says that they might have to pay something, they all do their thing and push their buttons, and then the Dow drops, right? And everybody freaks out. And then when they do something that looks, oh, okay, yeah, we'll give you the nod and the wink, then the things go up. I mean, they do play these games with, you know, people in position. It's sort of like a check on them. He goes, remember who is controlling this situation, and it's not you guys sitting over there in Congress or in the White House.
Right.
And, you know, and I think, you know, there's nothing, I think right now there's no better illustration of what the anti-corporate globalization movement was about. Mm-hmm. What indie media rose up out of, what all the people who were challenging the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. There are two sets of rules. If you are a super casino gambler in the United States, you have protectionism. You can do whatever the fuck you want, and the government will bail you out. So go fuck yourself if you think differently, basically. And if you're poor in your third world country and you've taken an IMF loan and you can't pay your debts,
right,
guess what? Fuck you. You have to sell off all your wealth and privatize it and give it to us because, well, tough shit. That's the way it works. So there's two rules in place for capitalists. There's those who are aligned with this very powerful state, like the United States, highly protectionist. Go fuck yourself if you think you're going to fuck with us. And then there's the rules for the rest of the world.
Right.
You know, and that's the nature of capitalism. And that's why I think, again, coming back to it, unless we talk honestly about what the interests these people represent, you know, you get into these details about Obama and these little sort of games that they play, and I understand that they have to, mm-hmm. and I understand your point, right? They have to sort of play these political machinations that they have to, you know, walk through, and they can't piss off these people, they can't piss off the military-industrial complex. It's probably why he's still going with Afghanistan. But you know, he has to play these games. But my point is again, politics is the shadow cast by big business over society. So what we're doing is sort of playing in the shadow, thinking what we're doing is relevant, when in fact, let's change our focus and look at the fundamentals of the economic system and challenge the fundamentals of capitalism, and then we can start talking about real democracy, because
right.
until we actually get rid of that kind of concentrated power, nothing is going to change. I mean, these people run the world, and if you... And again, I just have to say one more thing, because I brought this book with me, but I did an interview with this guy. He's a professor in Oregon, Pacific University. His name's Jules Boykoff. The title of the book is called Beyond Bullets, The Suppression of Dissent in the United States. It's a history of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'll just say it in a nutshell. If you think you ever want to get out of line or have free speech, you will be able to have free speech all day long, but the minute you're a real threat to the system, they will come down on you in ways that you can't even imagine. And he documents everything in here from, like, you know, firing you, following you around, and he goes through movements, and this is systemic. So there is no democracy, because if you are a threat to the established order, they will deal with you. If, you know, we can have a nice little radio show and talk about it, but if we actually establish real centers of power, they would fuck with us. Just like they did with a lot of activists over the last 50, 75 years.
Yeah, I know. And I know that you were you in New York you were locked up in New York for the Republican convention in 2004, right?
No, but friends of mine were.
Yeah.
It was IMC stuff.
Yeah, I knew. I swear I was in a meeting where people had been actually locked up, that, like, I was in a Kill Radio meeting with, that they went there.
Oh, yeah.
I hear you on that, and that pretty much is ugly truth.
I was thinking about, you know, I did that piece on Huey Newton, and some of the things that the FBI did in the 60s were almost comical. They were just so painfully obvious and open about working to suppress these people and characterize them as criminals and calling their breakfast programs a threat to society. I mean,
right.
it literally reached high comedy on some level. Although, at the same time, there were murders and, you know, things made to look like suicides and accidents as well. But some of it was just, like...
Right, right.
Openly ridiculous.
I agree with you guys on all that, but what I'm seeing is in 1999, the first sort of breakthrough of the to the American conscience was the protests of the World Trade Organization in Seattle. That got through on a mass level. Well, there have been people who have been following it. That was the thing.
Well, we were laid up here in the North because the quote unquote global South had been doing this for 20 years, challenging these policies.
Right, but like a beer swilling Democrat in Pennsylvania or moderate Republican
it shocked people here.
Yeah, it got through, and I think
Teamsters and Turtles.
But as you said, there was agitation. It was made to look like a bunch of crazy people who were just angry.
What we're seeing is
about something very non-specific.
But what I see is
exactly.
it's still following through. It's in line with what people are feeling. In that it's gotten more people have become more aware since then of that and feel that way since then, I think. So to a certain extent, the state can suppress all it wants, but more and more every day people feel exactly what you're saying. The system's basically rigged and it's moving in that general direction. I, to a certain extent, believe that Obama...
I don't know. I remember, when people were first starting to protest the war in Iraq, a lot of people were afraid to go to demonstrations because they thought they would wind up under surveillance, and they were concerned about.
I agree with you, but I'm talking more about that what people were. What I got out of the protests of the WTO was, this is unsustainable. You're basically taking you're oppressing labor worldwide in the United States over You're taking advantage of the system in a way that we're finally telling you guys we recognize it, and I think the more people saw that, the more people realized that that's true, and they got on board with that. And I think that even though Bush won, and even though Bush had a banner year in 2002 and won relatively handily in 2004, all arguments about how they manipulated all electronic voting aside, and the fear, please trust me, I had a anti-Bush bumper sticker that I thought twice of before I put on the back of my car. I get it. But I think if you look at the trend, this is where I'm saying the sustainability of it is meeting the reality of it. Like, people realize it's unsustainable, and people are more and more talking about it. So, yeah, you're right. If we all of a sudden became super powerful, I'd be in jail. But
right. I mean,
it's
that won't
going
happen.
In that direction. It's moved more in the direction of the ideal since 1999, in people's consciousness than it has than from 89 to 99.
True. And I think Bush had a lot to do with that, and this collapse. I mean, this is essentially depression era numbers, okay, apparently. But
and it's, by the way, going to get worse.
It's going to get worse for sure. But and I do think you're right. People are, but when a lot of people's friends, family, people they know, whatever, of getting laid off. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows somebody, right? So that has a huge impact on the way people think about things and start to question and open up and dialogue, which is a good thing.
Look at the Depression is when a lot of radical thinking came into the country, which people were punished for in the 50s. So it's an interesting time. Who knows what could happen? I mean, we're also in such an interesting era where thinking, thoughts, everything's interconnected globally. It moves with the speed of light. People can manifest their will in a way they never could before, so who knows what could happen.
Have you read or heard of, it's Naomi Watts' book, The End of America?
I've heard of it. And I'm a friend of hers on MySpace, but...
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. She's way too liberal for me, but I like her book a lot. But she has some sort of... putting aside some of the rhetoric she has at the beginning of the book, and her belief in the system and all that stuff, she does a fantastic job of documenting the 10 points of fascism that are arising in the U.S.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's frightening how, it's playbook material from many different fascist countries, and she goes into detail on all of them. You can actually, she has a couple of talks you can Google or search for, that she goes through the points. Yeah. It's a movie, actually, and I highly recommend it. But, and it's all based upon a lot of things that the Bush administration did, right? Mm-hmm. The language itself has changed with Homeland stuff. You know, that, I mean, that's ridiculous. That was
close to Nazi language.
That wasn't even the only thing. That was like, there literally these 10 points of, and she goes through them, and I'm trying to, at least off the top of my head, give you a couple, but the Patriot Act certainly had a lot of that stuff. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 certainly did. There was a number of other small pieces of legislation that were sort of quietly passed, mm-hmm. that were foundational changes in the way that they can do surveillance, the way they can release the FBI like the dogs of war that they were before the church committee hearings in the 70s. So I mean, but she goes into detail and it's pretty amazing. And Obama has done nothing to reverse any of those trends. And I think that's what's really frightening to me in the first 3 months of the Obama administration, is that his power, executive power, is not going to change. It's going to be identical to Bush, and he's already starting to use it in ways that are frightening. But
you don't see any progress or change?
None. Give me one example. I've heard even today reports that Guantanamo is even worse now than it was when Bush was around. And I heard that was a Democracy Now! This morning. You should listen to it. They go into detail. That was a public relations.
Announcing the end of it.
Yeah,
just a public relations.
To me, yeah. Because he's basically said, in Glenn Greenwald, mm-hmm. read his stuff, go and Google it on commondreams.org. What Obama's arguing is that, yeah, okay, we're closing Guantanamo, the Supreme Court has given rights to people there, but guess what? We have Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and we're going to do everything we're doing in Guantanamo there. You can't touch us. So he's essentially arguing through his Justice Department is that, well, yeah, Guantanamo, bad public relations, but we have Bagram, and we'll do whatever we want
there.
Right. And Greenwald documents this very carefully. I highly recommend it, so read it.
Well, yeah, he also came out today and said that he wasn't going to, you know, lower the veil of secrecy for the CIA or the FBI, so there you go.
I didn't see what they released, but they released the Bush memos rationalizing and sanctioning torture.
Right.
They released three of them today.
But you've got two things happening at the same time. One saying, here's some information about what was going on before, and then another one saying, we're not going to change our veil of secrecy. So,
I mean, seriously though, if you were charged with the responsibility of supposedly keeping the United States safe, and you have this United States, which has made enemies, made people...
We've made some enemies, and some of them, I mean, that's...
United States.
Yeah.
What is your other option besides the vast secret police that you've assembled?
Me, please, can I answer that?
Yeah.
I want to hear what you have to say.
You're asking the wrong question. The question is how can we keep the rest of the world safe from the United States? I mean, really, look in the last 30 years. Look how many people have been killed by U.S. wars around the world. I mean,
but that's what I said. This United States, the United States, it's baked in enemies. Now you take over.
Why do they have enemies? And my goal is to protect the people around the world from this government.
Well,
right?
For example,
that's the question.
Someone
could take a big shot at you. Like a whole bunch of Americans
it would suck. I mean, it's called, and that's the title. That's the concept of, or the title of, Chalmers Johnson's first book, Blowback. And he goes into it, you know. I mean, yeah, it's tragic, you know, and it sucks. But if we want to deal with the problem of blowback, then we have to deal with the fundamental issues of U.S. empire, and we have to understand it. We have to change its policies. We have to fight its wars of aggression,
right.
And more importantly, its resource extraction is what this is about.
Oh, of course,
right?
Of course. And
sorry. So no, I was going to say, do you think our entire war with Islam is based on that resource extraction only?
No. I mean, do I think that they're real fundamentalist, people, fundamentalist religious people who have it in for anybody different than them all over the world, yeah, I think it's...
I mean, we obviously have them here as well. Right. But I think that there is some threat that one could argue is really based on religious fundamentalism, and it's real. I don't know that we need to have deployed, you know, multiple millions of...
I just don't understand how we're supposed to unwind that so quickly.
Well, we start by, you know, shutting down most of our military bases around the world. I mean, Johnson argues this in his books, and he, you know, here's a guy who was a cold warrior. He actually was he was giving advice to the Nixon administration, Chalmers Johnson, that is, and, you know, taught at international public relations, Asia Pacific Rim stuff in Berkeley for a long time. This, and then here's a guy who comes around and says, shit, we're fucked. This is an empire, and unless we do something to shut down these bases, and here's why. You know, he's a radical shift in thinking, and that's why I recommend his books, you know, to people who don't really think of the U.S. as an empire. I'm not saying you don't. I'm just saying in general. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying?
No, I know we are, and actually, every now and then they actually let it be clearly seen by something that slips out, like when... I forgot, but they showed some map of U.S. bases around the world, and you could see that it's basically about surrounding Russia and China.
Yeah.
You know, there were a certain number of ones that were based
what NATO's
surrounding...
About.
Yeah, well, I mean, NATO stated that.
Yeah.
I mean, at least let's give them credit. The whole point of NATO was to do that. They surround Iran right now. I get it. You know, that is part of the playing field, but what I don't get is that if we were, and you're going to say this is the wrong question to ask, but like if we were to stand down, who's to say that someone wouldn't just fill those up with other armies?
Who? I mean, the U.S. is the global cop and is trying to run the world, and it's because of the economic collapse, it's failing to do so. And yeah, I mean, that's the nature of states, right? They're violent institutions by their very nature, and... You know, but the U.S. is the biggest kid on the block with the most nuclear weapons, spends more than any other country in the world on military.
Difference.
I mean, you know, let's start here, I guess. We're here at home, you know.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of my thing on that. I don't know. You know, and I know this is a very touchy subject, but I'm going to bring it up anyway since we're talking about Afghanistan. The Octomom. No.
Oh, God, don't go there.
But, last week I did an interview with Kevin Ryan, who's a chemist. Somebody I've interviewed a number of times. He's a co-author on a scientific paper. The lead author is this Danish guy, I think. Yeah, it's Danish. Basically, we now have the physical evidence for high explosives that were used to bring down the World Trade Center buildings. And it's, you know, very, very strict, you know, peer-reviewed paper. And we now have the physical evidence. And we know that, you know, these weren't planes that brought down these buildings, but high explosives. And the interview's still up if you're interested. It was 2 weeks ago from this coming Monday. So it would have been the 6th of April. 6th of April, kpfk.org in the archives, Indie Media on Air. But I go through all the details with him. But, you know, the foundation for the whole, you know, invasions of Afghanistan are, you know, false.
It's an echo of the Spanish-American War. That was fake, too. I mean, the origins of that were fake.
Yeah, I honestly, I mean, I've seen and not seen, I've just heard of the evidence that it wasn't...
There wasn't the planes themselves.
It wasn't the planes that did it, yeah.
I mean, many have questioned, I mean, from the beginning. I mean, you wonder how something that tall and that big and constructed the way that it was with the sort of outer support...
Imploded exactly
could have
as it
imploded
was
in the manner that it did.
Yeah.
Which is like...
Like every time they blow up a building.
Every time they blow up a building.
And it just shows, like it just falls into itself.
And this is a huge discovery because even though a lot of architects...
We never talk about the Pentagon either, which, you know, has just been erased from all discussions.
You know, it's... And you know, there's a lot of people out there, I'm convinced, are paid counter-information.
Right.
You know, people who are trying to... muddy the waters, but you know, I paid attention to this issue solely and primarily from a scientific perspective. So for the last 2 or 3 years, I've only pretty much interviewed scientists on my show about this topic, and I think that that's the only one that's really going to bring this subject to light, because even though there's a lot of other circumstantial evidence, it's very bizarre, very strange, and very compelling. I think the real nail in the coffin to this issue is that high explosives were found, that they're highly industrialized. It require a highly industrialized process to make nanothermite, which are, you know, and when you look at the paper, the science in, you know, the science is there, and it goes into a lot of detail. People not used to reading that kind of stuff can still probably get a lot out of it.
Right.
By just looking even at the photos, because when you see the photos and you see, understand that this is highly exothermic reactions that are happening here and are very would have to require an industrial process to make, and the quantities that they found are pretty staggering given the size of the stuff in the dust. But yeah, it's definitely high explosive, and it's definitely nano. It's what's called super thermite, and
any theories as to who?
Right. Well, what that would require to put inside these places, you know, is not going to be accomplished by 19 hijackers on an airplane. Let's put
it
that way.
Right.
And it's certainly not going to be manufactured anywhere outside of the United States, most likely. You know, or another, you know, industrialized
nation or militarized nation.
Right.
But the terrifying thing is anybody who witnessed the installation of this stuff would be dead anyway.
Well, not if they didn't know what it was, because the nature of this stuff is there's many different... They talk about it because this material was around and available in 99 at least, if not before, a little bit before that. It's definitely been published in papers Lawrence National Laboratories, they were working on this stuff too. They go into detail on some of this, but there's many different ways to apply it, and one is through using a gel process, almost like a paint. So there's different ways to apply it.
So they could have painted.
I mean, you wouldn't necessarily know that's what it is if you didn't know what you're looking for. Yeah.
You just got a great gig painting, you know, the stairwells of the World Trade Center.
Yeah, man, it was great.
It's gonna last like 3 years.
My last day on the job, September 11th.
Yeah, but it's one day.
I don't want to get sidetracked on that too much, but I just did want to point it out because most people don't even want to talk about it. But I really just think I urge people to look at the science behind it.
Oh, sure, and I think that it's. From a larger perspective, if your view of the United States includes that as being the case for 9/11, then there is kind of no hope.
Well, yeah.
There's zero. And cynicism rules. Because then there is no hope in any. Then they're all. Every single person involved in is complicit in it. As you know. And no one who could attain any form of higher office could do it without the tacit acknowledgement of it.
I have something to say to that. Here's the thing. People who studied American history, like yourselves and many others, and friends of mine on the quote-unquote left or whatever you want to call them, people like even Chomsky, they dismiss this as like, yeah, well, this is on atrocity scales, this is nothing. You know, they'll be like, let's talk about the Vietnam War.
Right.
You know, let's talk about the invasion of Iraq. So people who are know that the U.S. government is capable of extreme violence and the murder of millions of people, you know, they're like, well, what's the big, you know, it's not what's the big deal, but it's like, well, you know, the scale of things, this is 3,000 people. You know, my argument back to them is, well, look, you know how many people, when they realize that this is a possibility, will have their whole consciousness shift? And I've seen this happen, by the way.
Right.
And a lot of people have engaged people from the right and left going, it's like a deer in the headlights type of thing, all right? Or what in Snow Crash, the book, they referred to as a thousand-yard stare and a bad case of the mumbles. I don't know, you know, they don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And there's a teachable moment there, as organizers say. And I argue that, you know what, when people wake up to this reality, there's really some hope there. That a shift can happen in the way people think about the world and what's possible and what's necessary and what's the next step. So that's why I think it's important.
To be honest with you, there's no question. If you come to accept that, you can't view the world the same way as right. the minute before you came to accept it. There's no question about it. I do the whole, like, it wouldn't surprise me, but it just wouldn't surprise me if that was the case, but I can't really fathom the whole thing. Plus, at the same time, I don't know, I just don't give them that much skill.
Well, see, you're assuming that the government's responsible. My whole thing is, look at their model. What do? They privatize everything.
Right.
Let's contract this out to
Halliburton.
Our friends over there. They can manage this.
That seems like a much more likely scenario to me, that it was done by people who have real power and decided that it was time for it to happen.
In order to
justify.
Perpetuate.
Yeah, and actually the gap of ignorance would be more useful than people actually knowing why and what was going on.
Oh, sure.
I hear that all the time. Well, don't you think they couldn't keep a secret? I'm like, you're assuming that the government would even be involved in this. You know, these people are like, they're the ultimate privatizers. Like, are you kidding me? Let's contract this out to these 100 people here who are going to get paid a shitload of money, right. And they have no interest in, like, saying anything.
And that's why I go back to that whole example of the Spanish-American War, with those ships that were blown up by Hearst, reported on
these
newspapers, and thus drawing our government into a war that, you know, they had, you know, just kicking Spain out of this hemisphere. So it has precedent.
Yeah. And there's a lot of precedent. Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States goes into detail almost every occasion with the Mexican-American War,
right.
Spanish-American War, Vietnam War with the Gulf of Tonkin incident,
right.
The Iraq first Gulf War with the incubators, the babies in the incubator story. You know that one?
I don't know that story.
No, I don't remember.
Oh, my God.
That's not sure if I hear it. But
Operation Freedom, or whatever it was. Yeah.
Operation, the first one, right?
Yeah.
Number one, the prequel. sorry, bad joke. But, no, this woman, this young girl, who's from Kuwait, came to Congress and said, and started crying and explaining how the Iraqis came into the babies, into the hospitals, and these babies in incubators were smashed and thrown on the floor, right, in front of her eyes, and crying and blah, 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 and explaining how this. And it turns out she's the daughter of the U.S. The Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S. or something, right? And that there is a public relations firm who hired her to do this whole, you know, song and dance routine in front of the media and trained her to do this story. It never happened, by the way.
Right.
And then you see it, and then this is all covered.
Monsters.
This is all covered very well in, I think, one documentary I've seen. And they go through cut, 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 and you hear George Bush Sr. going, babies in incubators. You hear other pundits, babies in incubators, babies in incubators, babies in incubators, all the way down the Fox News channel, you know,
right.
The chain, right, back
right.
then. So you hear it repeated over and over about 100 times, and it's a genius, like,
right.
piece of documentary work going through the details. But that's how it works, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you need something. This time it was, what is it, weapons of mass destruction?
It was WMDs.
Right.
Yellow cake?
WMDs.
It was Jesus. It was this extremely unbelievable thread that somehow if those got out of Iraq, whatever unspecified WMDs were, and into the hands of the terrorists in 9/11,
many of us knew that
mushroom cloud.
The furthest reaching I'd ever heard in my life.
You know, it's funny. We were all sat on the sidelines going, from whatever persuasion you were, going, this is bullshit. But just watching the nation. I mean, if you look at it, up until he actually deployed troops, or until they actually.
The night of shock and awe. We were going to surgically remove Saddam in a matter of weeks.
The nation was 50-50 on the war. It wasn't fully 100% behind the war.
No.
It was. But then the nation always comes together when it's weird. It's another sort of paradigm shift. Once bombs start dropping, you'll get like a 66% approval for the war, like instantaneously.
Remember that. It still nauseates me. But
yeah.
Moving forward.
Sad. All right. Well, we've done basically a little more than an hour because I forgot to record the first 15 minutes of the show. Or I did, and it's just on another track. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
Technical wizard.
You're forgiven, because I don't know a damn thing about it either.
Yeah, I know. But I think we've covered it all. Chris.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
I thought it was cool. And
cool show. Great studio. Yeah. You guys are good hosts.
Thanks.
Great radio voice,
oh,
by the way.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
That's the common refrain, is that Steve's got the great voice.
Yeah, it's
I'm just tired.
the one thing I wanted to say, though, is I think you said this at a Kill Radio meeting a long time ago, which is if you actually asked everybody in here to describe, you know, how they would want to live, like the type of world they'd want to live in, we'd all come up with pretty darn close to the same description, like how we get there or what we deeply believe in certain areas may not actually match. But if you talk about the basics of what we would want, if you said, here, you know, this is your perfect world, and you'd be like, we'd all be really close to each other to a certain extent. And I kind of think in the name of, like, you know, I think it was, like, freaking awesome. I love having someone who's extraordinarily well-read and well-versed in what they were talking about. We had Katrina's mom on earlier, and she...
See, what we need is to have those two on together.
No.
Yes.
You know,
oh, no, we do.
To put Damaris
we do indeed.
In the same room together.
That's going
to
be the next level.
I would love to come back anytime. It's been great actually talking to you. And thank you for inviting me. And, yeah. And you know what I love the most, I think, is seeing people have the capacity to create this in this room and have your own show.
Right.
Because a lot of people can do that now. And, you know, get a few friends together and, you know, find their own voice,
right.
Have that experience, you know. And it's amazing, you know, and people should take advantage of it.
I mean, we're kind of living in the golden age where we can still do it.
Right.
There'll be a time when the just
stop
active
it.
Doing
stop
this.
Stop it. Don't give anybody any ideas.
We'll be, you know, contraband. But seriously, thanks. And yeah, I'd love to have you back. I'd love to stay in touch.
Cool.
But and the definitive word is, so from when you wrote your open letter till now, zero progress.
I'm still waiting.
Okay.
I'm still waiting.
Okay. I deep down inside have a hope that some of what he's saying is actually going to turn into something that I want to see. Not necessarily, I think, on a structural level, but the structural level that you examine, but I think in certain areas, in terms of
you start talking, dismantling the entire system is going to be virtually impossible. I mean, you're talking about 400 or 500 years of something that's clearly taking a life of its own. But maybe in the environmental front, that could manifest. I hope so.
His rhetoric on the environment is that he wants us to become the nation that produces the green technology. So if China still wants to
even
grow,
even if we
they
just
can,
went with some goddamn public transportation. I mean, I'm sorry, we do live in LA. We are personally, all of three of us, are contributing to the things we're talking about.
I know.
Just by virtue of the lifestyles we lead. So I mean, you know,
but those are choices that were given. Forced upon us too.
They're forced upon us, but I also think that we have to be hard on ourselves.
True.
As well. If
I agree.
You really want to take responsibility, then we really have to go a little further. So there's a lot I think that's going to be asked of everybody.
I agree.
If we really want to make it happen.
Completely agree. And just one last thought. When you're talking about Obama versus McCain, and again I come back to Chomsky, who I really have admired over the years, and he said that, look, the U.S. is an incredibly vast system of power, and slight modifications at the top can have drastic consequences at the bottom. So even, you know, even the terminology used can have an effect on, you know, the most vulnerable in the society. So, you know, even, you know, a few modifications can actually make the difference in people's lives. But for me, you know, again, it's systemic, and I want to see systemic changes, which that's what I always come back to talking about. But, you know, we have to acknowledge that, you know.
I don't think we're going to see systemic.
No, I personally. Well, I think that they're going to be forced upon us.
Yeah. No, exactly.
You know, I don't want to be too. I mean, I don't want to end on such a cynical note. I mean, I think this country has evolved. It continues to evolve. I think it always comes back to the people wanting to change.
And on that level, I kind of think that what you saw in 99 in Seattle and what people who are unaware and don't care, you're starting to see those two
and
things.
And what we saw manifesting, culminating in the 60s and 70s, which was a push that started in the 19th century for all sorts of things to change.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that we have to give people here credit for some of
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
You know, we're not the same as we were in 1865 or even 1965 in many ways. Some people have gone backwards, that's for damn sure.
If only
if we go back to Katrina, some never changed from 1865.
That's
but many have.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if only protesting was as in vogue as it was in the 60s.
Well, I mean, it's a whole other... we should come back and talk about the 60s and 70s alone, but, you know, there's a different, entirely different population that were...
Different population, different circumstances.
Different, you know, educational backgrounds, right. Different class backgrounds, and a lot more, you know, economic stability.
Right.
Well, for the majority, certainly not for black people and poor people of color. But you know, there's a lot of other variables that played into that, you know. Yeah. And I think understanding what is going on now and those differences is probably really important.
Oh, I've been waiting for that. And if you want to do a show on that, I would love to.
Yeah, that would be great.
That to me is the key of what has gotten us to here. Is the difference?
We're
not understanding the difference between that, what happened then, and why it happened, and why it's not happening now.
So, I mean, you could look at someone like Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton was radicalized by the threat of the draft. I mean, so there's it is very different.
That's true.
Yeah.
The draft is a major factor.
Major factor. It's what radicalized the white middle class. In many ways.
Absolutely.
So. All right. Well, thanks again, Chris.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
The show that will never
stop. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, man. Good to meet you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.